The night is darkest just before dawn, and I promise you, the dawn is coming. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I'm a total and complete shit show. And I found out that I was an adult child at 9 years of sobriety after 9 years of toxic romantic relationships and not being able to figure out what the hell was wrong with me. And then coming to the realization that my childhood that I knew wasn't ideal was actually trauma. So for any new listeners, welcome aboard this hot mess of a ship. This is where we put the fun and dysfunctional. This is where we talk about serious shit, but we don't take ourselves too seriously. In case you didn't figure it out yet, we curse here. You've been warned. So today we are diving deep with two lovely ladies. So we have returning guest, Dr. Amelia Kelly. She was on just a few months ago. I'll put her first episode in the show notes in case you want to go listen to that. It was a gem. And we have Gina Cavalier, and they are the co-authors of the newly published book, this nice fluffy summer read, as I say to them, Surviving Suicidal Ideation, From Therapy to Spirituality, and the Lived Experience. So in this book, Amelia provides the clinical information, the perspective, and the knowledge from a therapist. And then Gina is the one providing the lived experience. And I have to say, I read through it, and it is packed full of really good information. Specifically, there's a lot of detail about various modalities of healing. Now, I just want to say this first, just get this out of the way, okay? This is not a dark and depressing episode about suicide. This is not an hour-long conversation of talking about killing ourselves, okay? We definitely have had much heavier episodes on the podcast than this. However, this is a really important conversation to have because this is a thing. This is a common symptom of trauma. This is something that is common in society at large. And so it is an important discussion to have, right? Like, this is something that we shouldn't be scared to talk about. But I just want you to know that we're talking about a bunch of other things too, okay? We're also talking about personality disorders. We are talking about the differences between PTSD and complex PTSD and the differences in treating those. We're going to get to hear Gina's backstory. So this is an interview packed full of useful information for you all to hear. So before we dive into the episode, and that's not me saying, but first, let's talk about why you, yes, you. I'm not saying that. I'm not there yet, so don't skip ahead. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to take a moment to address something that I think is incredibly timely and relevant. So if you have been feeling the weight of the world lately, you know, the state of our nation, the heightened discourse, the tension in conversations, you are not alone. You know, the truth is navigating relationships in this political climate isn't just about getting through a family dinner or an office meeting. You know, it's also about our well-being, our resilience, our peace of mind. And just like we can learn to set healthy boundaries with loved ones dealing with addiction, how I manage my relationship with my parents, we can apply those same boundary setting skills to interactions with people we might clash with politically. And it's not just helpful, it is absolutely essential. So that is why now more than ever, I am really urging you to consider attending the workshop that is happening tonight. So tomorrow, but tonight for you, if you're listening to this on the day the episode drops, so November 13th. So Wednesday, November 13th, 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific, we have the Stop Overgiving, Repair Your Life from the Inside Out with the Boundaries Queen herself, Boundaries Coach, fellow shit show Barb Nangle, who will not only share practical tools you can use right away, but you're also going to have the opportunity to ask personal questions that you might have on setting boundaries effectively, even in the most challenging situations. And I will tell you that today I called Barb to get her advice on setting boundaries. And we don't call her a boundaries expert for nothing, okay? We don't call her a boundaries expert for nothing, folks. I mean, this woman knows what she's doing. So yes, I don't miss out on this opportunity to really learn how to set boundaries, improve your relationship, take back your peace of mind. You need this now more than ever, okay? So go see the link in the show notes to sign up. Trust me, you're going to thank me afterwards, okay? But now let's get on with the damn show. But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to damn the joint stitches. And I don't know if you can hear this in the background, but my cats are going crazy in a box. They're playing in a box right now. So this is my online support community where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. So this is relational trauma. We heal through safe relationships. This is a place where you can do so. It's less than $1 a day. Is your healing worth less than $1 a day to you? I'd say so. So do the damn thing. See the link in the show notes. Join next. Give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at Adult Child Pod. And last but not least, whatever you do, please, please, please give me a 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. Thank you. Love you all. All right, y'all. Well, have a return. What? Oh, I thought you were talking.
She's just ready. She revs. She revs up her energy. All right.
Well, these ladies are ready to go.
I'm feeling it.
Yeah. So we have the co-authors of a newly published book. It's very light and fluffy. It's a nice summer read called Surviving Suicidal Ideation. We have Dr. Amelia Kelly back with us. Yay. And we have Gina. I should have asked how to pronounce your last name, but Cavalier is how I'm gonna go with
that's it. Yeah,
correct.
Co-author and a little doodler and an illustrator. Okay, so we've already gotten to know Amelia some. So before we talk about the book, we got to get to know you some, Gina.
Okay.
So my first question always is, when did you realize that your childhood screwed you up a lot more than you thought it did initially?
Kind of as it was happening. I knew it, you know, I was very intuitive when I was a kid and I could see energies, and I was sort of like, as a child, I remember being just very sensitive. I love the world. I love people. I just came in fully, even like an elder, I had a wisdom about me. And I was just like, oh, this is messed up. I knew as it was happening, something wasn't right. But as it went along, and I kind of downplayed it. And as I was in sort of my 20s, I realized that I put it behind me and I buried it so deep that it had now had created giant wounds within my soul. And it took me about in my 30s, like after my first divorce, that I really needed to, you know, make some changes and dive deep and fix some stuff. Yeah.
What was that moment in your 20s when you realized that you had buried it?
I really loved talking about spirituality and going down that road. And I wanted to open up that childlike spirit again. And I realized it was like covered in soot and heaviness and, you know, because I hadn't embraced it anymore. I dumbed it down for the people that were around me, because the people I chose were not in that phase in their life of expression, of expressing themselves fully and authentically, especially with spirituality. So I kind of dumbed it down and just kind of was marching along with the world that I had created. And I was not being authentically myself. I couldn't talk about the things I wanted to talk about. My group wasn't into things like that. So, you know, you realize that you've pulled in a lot of trauma people because you're traumatized, and we're just over traumatizing each other just constantly, but they weren't really, I wasn't being authentic to myself. So I wasn't even allowing the people that would really resonate with me in, because, you know, I was like, oh, I don't want to do that healing stuff, that spiritual stuff, or that go to a therapist stuff. You know, I was sort of living this rock and roll lifestyle, and it was not, you know, I eventually had to make a decision to kind of like leap out of that to save myself.
You want to talk about that moment?
Sure. It's very scary, but it's also very liberating. And the scary thing is that, you know, a lot of people who have been traumatized or had like abusive childhoods, you know, they don't want to lose another person. You know what I mean? They think they're losing a person. So I would go into panic mode, go, I'm going to lose this person who I have all these memories with, or this history. We go out, party, we talk, we chat, but not realizing that I'm not really losing them. I'm actually just taking experiences from that person and I'm moving in a different direction that's healthier for me. But when you go on again, off again, meet even with suicidal ideation or you have depression, you don't want to lose another person. But in reality, they might not be the best person for you to be sharing time with. And so that's fearful. That scares you even more. You're like, I'm going to lose more people. So I was in this constant phase of scared to lose the people that really weren't that great for me. So I had to go through a purging process and a healing process for myself and realize that I was able to now, once I was more healed and I was more authentic and I was more grounded, I could actually call in people that resonated with me a little bit more, where we can actually, we kind of are on the same page. And it's okay that I'm not on the same page with those people. There's no judgment, you know? It's like everybody's at a different place. And, you know, I used to just think maybe I'm a bad person if I'm not going to be friends with that person or things like that. And those are just things that really block us from healing and block us from moving forward. And realizing I had that control and that it was important that I had that, you know, this new world that I was building around me of people that, you know, I could share my life the way that I wanted to express myself authentically. Because I think that causes a lot of depression if you can't be, you can't talk to people or you can't share. And yeah.
Well, you were, yeah, afraid of losing people, but it was coming at the expense of losing yourself to remain in the relationship. So
there you go. You summed it up great.
So paint the picture of your childhood.
Well, it was the 70s and my mom was a dancer and my dad worked in a casino and a car salesman. So they were zoot suits, big hair, you know, all about their looks, you know, the square sunglasses, the suits. My mom wore the little mini skirts and, you know, they had kids because it was cute and they weren't ready to be parents. And they just kind of, and it was of the time where they were like, you know, hey, we gave you life, go ahead and explore. So they weren't around a lot. There was a lot of drinking around. There was a lot of abuse. And then my parents got a divorce when I was about 8. And then my dad, who was the abusive parent, got custody of me. And it was just him and I. And he was a binge drinker. And he would black out and he would beat me a lot. And I was just, I was almost like the little mini wife, you know, cleaning the house, taking care of him, cooking for him, making drinks for his friends. Mm. And he was just, you know, the last time I saw him at that time, I was about 12. He almost beat me to death. And my mom, I did get to a phone call and she lived about 45 minutes away and she was able to get to me, but she found me in a corner, passed out. He was just kicking me. So she got me away from him. And then I didn't see him again until I was about 18, 19. So, you know, that abuse, and especially when it's a father figure, you lose all the security. You don't have a sense of safety. And so, you know, I married my first husband. He was an alcoholic. It was what I knew. Mm-hmm. I did not know that I could, that's what I'm saying about going back to the earlier thing, that I could create the world that I really wanted, you know, take charge of it, saying, no, I have these boundaries. I don't want that in my life anymore. So that's kind of how it evolved. It's a lot in the book. The details are in the book. Mm-hmm. And the publisher wanted some of those details because they wanted, which at first they were like, no, we need more, Gina. I was like, oh, I'm going to do this one time. You know, I'm not putting this in other books. This is the only book that's going to really have a lot of my personal life because I've healed from it. But I do think it does give people an understanding of like, okay, you know, that's where she came from. And now I can see the healed version. So I think it is important in our topics for people to see like where I came from and what maybe why I created those wounds or had those wounds.
I guess what would be the resistance in not sharing it?
I don't mind sharing it at all. It's just, I don't want to do it all the time because now I want to be in my experience now, as I've healed it more, I'm starting to lose authentic feelings of it. I don't know if that makes sense. So even my suicidal ideation, I wanted to write now while I was healing, because I could authentically tap into the emotions as I was writing. But I've healed, I'm getting to the point where I'm healing so much, even when I try to remember them, they're fading. I mean, getting like a deeper healing. And I'm so grateful. Like, I can't tap into those memories as much. So, and as I express them, I want to be authentic and I want to, you know, to be able to express it, but I'm actually losing the ability to go into those memories. It's just, it's fading. It's a good thing, but you know, it's really going away. And it's another level I didn't expect of healing. You know,
you see me dying to say something about this, right?
Okay, go ahead. Die. Go.
Well, because since I work on, you know, I work with trauma, like that is my whole bread and butter and my passion. And I mean, I've experienced it myself in times of doing like EMDR personally or brain spotting personally, that it's almost like the difference between being in the waterfall versus standing behind the waterfall and seeing it in front of you. And you might get trickled a little, you might get little splashes of it, but you're not being pounded by it. Mm-hmm. And so because of what I know about Gina, like the way that she connects is so deeply present that I could see where, and she was going through some pretty traumatizing things while we were writing the book, which I think you touch on a little bit in the book, but it reminds me of how after EMDR, for instance, a feeling that used to feel super present can almost feel like you're watching it on a movie screen. So there's a little bit of a distance from it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I feel like that's kind of what you're saying. Yep. I don't see you as being someone who's going to not talk about your past, but the way that she talked about her past in the book was like, it was like a memoir. It was so detailed and so in depth. I mean, my favorite, most authentic moment was when you were talking about the little fort that you made for yourself as a child to stay safe in. And she went into the details of like the little things she had in there with her and how she would almost created her own home inside her closet. And so the details of which she goes into in the book are pretty depthful.
Yeah. So how did you guys connect?
Yeah, I can tell this time. Yeah. It's funny. I looked at her because we always have like these, who's going to tell
the story?
Who's going to tell this story? So my first book, What I Wish I Knew, Surviving and Thriving After an Abusive Relationship, years ago was published. And I actually went on Gina's podcast, which is no longer happening, called The Liberated Healer. Mm-hmm. And I was just saying this in an interview the other day. I need to go back and re-listen to our episode together because it was the first time we met. But I think it just sparked something in her that she had been searching for and looking for sharing her story. Mm. And she reached out to me maybe a week later. Yeah, it wasn't even that long. Yeah. Very, very soon after.
Yeah.
And you know, it's funny. I was on a number of podcasts and they don't all stand out to me, but I remember just really liking and connecting and just having like a good jive. And so she asked if I would be interested in co-authoring this book with her. And I always laugh that literally the day prior, I had signed a contract with Penguin for my gaslighting book. So I'm like, oh my gosh, do I do this? Do I jump? And I said, yep, let's go for it.
Let's roll, baby.
Yep. So I would never advise anyone write two books that are completely separate from each other ever again, because
yeah.
I've also said that the way that I write is kind of similar to how like a method actor functions where you immerse yourself in a topic.
So gaslighting and suicidal ideation?
Well, no, this one joy. You know, I could have actually done a little bit better, I think, doing the gaslighting and suicidal ideation together. No, I was writing the ADHD book.
Oh, yeah.
And the SI book. So I'm just like total opposite planes of the spectrum while writing. But it was a huge experience from start to finish.
Are there any connections with ADHD and suicidal ideation? Anything there?
Well, if you look at the fact that folks with ADHD, first of all, the way that the genes express sometimes come from trauma in high stress environments. So trauma doesn't create ADHD, but it can kind of aggravate executive functioning issues or things like that. But then also the shame that can come with ADHD, the rejection sensitivity, the overcorrections that kids can experience where A study have found that children with ADHD can experience up to 10,000 more corrections by the age of 12, which is wild. And so you think about the things that can create all the suffering that leads to suicidal thoughts. I wouldn't put it past that it could be connected.
And Gina, did you come to her and specifically say, I want to write a book about suicidal ideation, or was that, I want to tell my story?
Well, I had been wanting to write this because I just felt that that was going to be my mission. I could tell, right? And I was already writing like the proposal or the ideas out, and something kept telling me while we were recording, ask her. And it came out of nowhere. It came out of absolutely nowhere because I did 200 episodes. So, I mean, I did a lot. And a lot of doctors. And I was like, okay, like it was so loud. So I don't know, you know, these were just ideas at this point. But what I kept hearing and feeling was, yes, my story was important. Yes, my healing journey was important, but that I needed a bigger, wider scope. I needed clinical information from a trusted source, because some people very much need to hear my version and my story and my experience, but some people very much need and want to have a clinical voice. And I couldn't provide that. And I didn't even know that until that happened. It, to me, it was just, you know, when you get really healed too, what I love about it is your intuition gets strong. When you learn to love and appreciate that intuition and listen to it, that's how I live my life now. And it pulls you in directions. Meet this person, talk to this person, say yes to that, say no to that. And my intuition is like so strong now because I have a appreciation, love, and I'm listening. And I listened and I was like, okay. And I literally just wrote her. I had a little mini proposal already written. Would you write this with me? And she came back about 45 minutes and said yes. Other really weird thing is when I was going through a very big, like a divorce, it was a very intense, I was trying to find myself. I was really lost. I went to this beautiful tattoo artist who drew these beautiful faces, right? And I was so numb. I wanted to feel something. So I booked a tattoo with him, but I didn't know what I wanted. And so he's like, what do you want? And I just was like, how about Amelia Earhart? And I put a tattoo. I've had it lasered off since, but I had a tattoo of Amelia Earhart. I just kind of pulled it, and it's a rare name. It's unusual. And then I had it removed. And then I swear to God, I felt like spirit or my energy said, I told you, Amelia. It was like there, because I really believe in this circle of life and how we meet people is very interesting. So I very much feel like it was divinely guided that I needed that. So.
And I loved when she told me that story because, P.S., Amelia is not rare anymore, and I am bitter about it. I am going to be so angry when I see my name on a keychain at a gas station. I know it's coming, but it's already there for sure. Anger. But I was technically named after Amelia Earhart because my mom was obsessed with Joni Mitchell, and there's a song called Amelia, which is about Amelia Earhart. So I was like, oh, that's kind of cool.
What a random tattoo to get.
I know, right? But then she lasered me off, guys.
No, she was just making room for you. Yeah. Oh, get a big old, you're just your face.
Yep.
I'm a tramp next. Stamp of your face.
I'll send you my picture.
But was the idea from the get-go, Gina, that you wanted to really touch upon suicidal ideation?
Oh, yeah. So the mission is, when I really realized that this is healed, actually, like when a big life event comes, a breakup, you know, I still have them, you know, things are, you know, things going on. I used to go through this whole period of like, it would feel like it was coming, you know, it's like, oh, I lost my job. Okay. In a few days, I'm going to start to like play this record in my head that I'm worthless. I'm never going anywhere, whatever was playing in whatever my story was. Right. When I realized that record player had been smashed, that it was gone, that I actually cannot hold a suicidal thought. I really can't. It's interesting. Like even if I was to try to think about things like that, my body would start to giggle or laugh, or there's something that has absolutely transformed in me where I can't hold a self-harming thought for myself. I have other thoughts, but not any of that at all. I just can't. I wanted to share that with people that were suffering, because it's a slow death in itself if you spend your entire life with on again, off again, or even a suicidal ideation. It's scary, because anytime a life event comes, it can just come right to the forefront. And you don't need, if you don't want that in your life, I think that there's steps where you can really actually heal that. And I wanted people to know this, that's the whole mission, that this, I believe, and I am an example, that you can heal this. Everybody has a different story and a different path. So I don't know, you have to do the work, but it can be. And I wanted people to know that, because if I knew that like 10 years ago, if I heard that from someone else, I would say, really?
Bullshit.
I don't live with this. Okay. I'm going to, that person represents a place I can get to. Let's go for it. That's why I wanted to do this. It's like, yes, you can. Please try.
Well, and to be clear, she did just outright say, do you want to write a book about suicidal ideation? She said, I want to write a book about recovering from suicidal ideation. Yeah. Are you game? So it was, I mean, you were very direct about like what your mission was. Yeah. It wasn't just, I want to write a memoir. I think also because What I Wish I Knew had a similar format. Mm-hmm. I wrote about a survivor of domestic violence, yep, who had left her abuser. And so I think Gina had seen me participate almost in this kind of group therapy through a writing project. So it was almost similar. However, she had to pull me off the ledge from not getting too much in that space like I did with Kendall Land, because with Kendall Land, there's a huge distinction. Her story, my clinical take. Her story, my clinical take. Whereas with Gina, there were moments where we kind of became more intertwined in the storytelling. And so there was a bit of an adjustment with that. But is that wrong to say that because of the format of What I Wish I Knew, that might have inspired it a little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so.
I mean, writing books with co-authoring is, you know, a unique.
It's not for the weary.
So I love it though, because I love working with teams. I love bringing looping people in. I've always been like that in all of my projects though. I just come in, come all, you know, it's just fun.
Well, you need that personal experience to really connect with people. And then you also need to make sure that you're, you know, giving people the right information and tools and healing from somebody who's an expert. So it's really the best of both worlds. Gina, do you remember the first time that you, how old were you when you first seriously considered committing suicide? Do you have a memory of that?
Yeah, I was about 8 when my parents got a divorce. I just didn't feel I belonged here, not just because of the abuse, but I also had severe neglect. So as a child, I think, at least in my experience, I knew I was cute and wonderful and beautiful and deserved all the love in the world. I knew it. Like, I just was like, I'm so cute. You know, I'm just like, oh, look at these flowers. Like, I was just this flower child, you know, but then I would look at my family and they didn't want anything to do with me, or they were gone. And they never told me they loved me. They weren't holding me. They weren't rocking me. They weren't feeding me food. You know, there was a severe neglect. And so you just, as a child, go, why? What happened? Like, you really know, you know, even as a young child, something's not right. Like, I deserve love. I deserve kisses on the face and reading a book, you know, and things like that. I never got any of that. And I taught myself how to read when I was really young because I wanted to learn. And my parents, when I went to school, I already knew how to read above all the other kids, and they didn't understand why. And they were like, we don't read to her. We have no idea how she learned how to read. You know, they just didn't understand. They were proud of me. They were like, oh, she's a genius. I was like, no, I just really wanted to learn. So, you know, I actually took cassette tapes and would take the lyrics out and I would listen to the words and I would read them out loud. And that's how I taught myself how to read.
Oh, that's cool.
That's interesting. Yeah. Did you have siblings?
I had a brother from my mom's prior marriage, but I didn't know that we didn't have the same father. And he wound up having a motorcycle accident when he was 19. I was 14. So, you know, he drank himself to death 10 years later. So he had, after the accident, and I know Amelia has expertise in TBI, traumatic brain injury. He had a traumatic brain injury. So yeah, we lost him that way.
What were the circumstances that your father got custody of you?
he actually trickeried me. He knew I really wanted a family. He was very good at trickery. My dad was married a lot of times. He had scattered kids at that time. He just didn't want to pay child support. So he convinced me, he actually married another woman with three daughters. And he convinced us at me that we were going to build this family. He knew I wanted a family life. And right after he got, my mom was like, are you sure you want to live with him? And I was like, yeah, he's changed. He doesn't drink anymore. He's marrying this lady. They have three kids. We're going to build a little family. I remember it. She remembers it too. And immediately after he got custody of me, he started drinking again. And the woman said to my mother, why didn't you tell me he was like this? She goes, would you have believed me?
Exactly.
And she tried, he actually started drinking. He got into a violent rage. He started beating her and trying to hit her kids. And they ran away to a hotel and she tried to take me and he followed him and he ran into the hotel and he goes, not this one. And he grabbed me. He goes, you can leave, but you can't have this one. So yeah.
Have you ever looked into any of the adult children of alcoholic stuff?
Yeah.
And then what do you know about your parents' upbringings?
Well, my dad went in the war when he was 18 in the Korean War and he was shot in the head. So he had a metal plate put in his head. So, you know, he went to war very young and his father was abusive and his mother was neglectful and fell in love with another man while the dad was at war. And that, you know, he was desperate for his mother's attention. And I think that's why he married so many women. Mm-hmm. And my mom actually was raised by her siblings and had to go into foster care. Mm. So it is definitely, you know,
yeah,
it is.
So what were some like misconceptions about suicide or suicidal ideation that you thought were particularly important to address?
Well, you know, one of the big things that was important to me to convey was that bringing up that you are having those thoughts doesn't necessarily mean you're going to run out and do it that day. You know, our mission really is to normalize the thoughts of suicide almost as much as if we would talk about feeling anxious. Mm-hmm. Because it's so much more common. It's a myth that it's not common. It's up to 15%, if not more, of humans have suicidal thoughts in their lifetime. And that's only what's reported. Like, that's not getting into the depths of all of our inner thoughts. And so if we keep something under the rug and keep it taboo, it makes those people feel even more othered. And it's so important to me, especially as a clinician, because I have so many people that come to me that I know they're afraid to even tell their therapist sometimes that they're having these thoughts because of the fear of being locked up or put away or, you know, something like that, that is against their will. And I think even as healers and helpers and therapists, anyone who's of a human serving space, it's important not to panic. It's important to stay level and listen and be non-critical. There's another, I don't want to say it's a myth. It's a thing that I'm sure we've all heard and it irks me. If I hear one more person say, oh, that person's just trying to get attention, I'm going to scream. Because guess what? They need help. They need support. What's the difference really between just trying to get attention? I get it. You know, there can be the boy that cried wolf, I guess. But I think when it comes with suicide, we need to not ever adopt that mentality. Because the whole point of bringing it up is to need community and need connection. So I just think the whole way we talk about suicidal thoughts needs to change.
Because I was going to bring that up. I was going to ask that question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, obviously. I think when you think about it, though, it's, let's say somebody is doing it for attention. Like, clearly, they have issues.
Right?
Yeah, they have issues. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So right.
It's kind of like, I think about that from the perspective of people on like TikTok or whatever saying that they have DID or whatever. They might not have whatever that is, but they clearly like have something.
Right.
Where would that be most prevalent as far as someone using that as attention seeking behavior? Would that be like a borderline thing or like a histrionic or because it is a thing, right?
It is a thing. So the two things that you brought up, which I'm sure your listeners have probably heard you talk about, but you know, borderline personality is generally a trauma response, a collection of behaviors that exist because of trauma and not having effective coping mechanisms.
Yes.
And the need for excess attention, whether or not it is good or bad attention, is very prevalent with borderline. Mm-hmm. And so, but here's the thing, this is the risky thing here. Borderlines are also more likely to actually engage in these risky behaviors, right? So I think the big thing is that if you're like in a relationship with, or you have a loved one or a family member, or even as therapists, you know, with my therapist at my practice, I limit them to 2 to 3 borderline cases per therapist. Not because we have like 15 therapists. So we can see quite a few at any given time, but the matter is that the amount of emotional energy it takes to give someone with borderline personality the space and the energy they need, and also to practice boundaries safely, it can also be emotionally taxing on the person receiving the receiving end. Right, on the receiving end.
But what are your thoughts on that as far as like borderline versus CPTSD?
So the thing about, okay, I believe that people with borderline personality disorder have CPTSD.
Yes.
Right. But people with CPTSD don't always end up having borderline tendencies. So
what is the what would you say would make somebody borderline versus just because I mean, we got a lot of the same things, right? We got like a big fear of abandonment is like you know, the main thing. But what would you say actually differentiates the
main
two?
Difference? I think the method in which you get your needs met is a big determining difference. For example, someone who is borderline, as I was saying, is more likely to engage in risky behaviors. And this could be things like self-harm. But the big, you know, the big difference, the flavor difference has to do with the ability to have safe boundaries in relationships. There's this interpersonal chaos that follows someone with borderline personality. And I'm not saying that these things don't exist for someone with CPTSD, but the extent is clinical. It's just a much more intense manner, an intense amount. And I have to be honest, I don't walk around diagnosing borderline. I don't really ever diagnose it because to me, it's trauma. It's a collection of trauma symptoms. But I think it serves a purpose if you're trying to help someone get the treatment they need. Like dialectical behavioral therapy is the most researched and supported. Seeking Safety is another manual that's often used with borderlines. So yeah, I think it's, to me, for me, I can sense the difference, but that's hard to describe.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if you know, he has a psychology in Seattle, Dr. Kirk Honda. I had him on a long time ago to talk about it. It's a couple of things there. And I think that social media has just really heightened things. Mm-hmm. And I do feel like there is an attention seeking thing that has come up in society more so than not. Mm-hmm. I almost feel like there's like something sexy almost like, oh, I have a personality disorder. And I also wonder too, if when you say you have a personality disorder, there's also an element of that as far as like they're saying that it can't fully be treated. But when I asked Dr. Honda about it, he goes, it doesn't really matter to me because I'm going to treat the person based off the symptoms. So you can label it whatever you want.
Right. Which I'm agreeing with him when I say I don't necessarily walk around diagnosing BPD. I more so look at it as trauma and treat the trauma. But to your point about like BPD being sexy and whether or not it keeps people stuck, I do want people to understand when it comes to personality disorders not being treatable, okay? Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that they can't be
get help.
It doesn't mean you can't get help. It doesn't mean you can't be supported. Do you want to know what that literally means, folks? All it means is you can't medicate it. That's what it means. It means that you can't medicate a personality disorder. So it's not something that can medically be cured. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that you can't treat it and that people can't learn and improve. It's kind of like how this is a totally different realm, but you can't quote cure autism because you don't medicate You don't change. There's people who would say things about diet and whatnot, but you can help support, you can do behavior mod, you can treat it.
Yeah.
So I don't necessarily, I think the verbiage is very misleading when someone's not in the clinical world and they hear, oh, I got BPD. That's it. This is the end of the line.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, well, first of all, I think that like, I mean, I think the trauma is always with, I think we can heal to a certain amount, but like, there's no way I'm never going to become the person that never, you know, had it at all. It's always going to be part of me. And the other thing too, is I know that they are, there's been talks to like more so move to like having all of the personality disorders more like on a spectrum of like all of them together, as opposed to like diagnosing individual.
Do you shit shows ever feel like you're just too damn busy to eat healthy? So I used to feel this way. Every day I would wake up with the intention of eating clean, and before you know it, it's 10:30 p.m., I'm in my bed, and I'm eating smart food popcorn. That is, until I found the perfect solution. Meal kits from Sunbasket. No matter what your lifestyle is, Sunbasket caters to your kind of healthy. Every single recipe is shit show proof, so pre-measured, pre-proportioned, easy to prepare. I most recently made the seared Alaskan halibut with mashed potatoes and herb brown butter parmesan sauce, and it was damn good. And for you shit shows out there who only know how to work a microwave, Sunbasket also has pre-made meals that are ready to eat in less than 5 minutes. No prep, no mess. So go to sunbasket.com/adultchild today to save $120 off your first 4 deliveries. That is sunbasket.com/adultchild to save $120 across your first 4 deliveries, plus free shipping on your very first order.
Okay, shit show dudes, you can tune out. This is for my fellow shit show ladies. Are you going through perimenopause or menopause? I'm not quite there yet, but I know that I have plenty to look forward to. Feeling like a wet sock driving down the highway. Night sweats. Poor sleep. Feeling tired all the time. Bloating. Gas. Man, can't wait for this shit. Now, if that is applicable to you, then you have to try Hormone Harmony. So Hormone Harmony is not just a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 fucking seconds, okay? Now, Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work. Now, for my younger shit show women like myself, if you struggle from that vicious week before your period, you want to crawl out of your skin, experience cravings, want to eat everything in the damn house, you feel a little bit down or off, well, Happy Mammoth also has a product for you to make it easier to manage your PMS with their Estro Control. So for a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ADULTCHILD at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ADULTCHILD for 15% off today.
I'm laughing because I think the DSM, I think they do that with everything. Like right now there's talks of combining ADHD and autism, which is insane. Really? That's just insane because it's completely different brain mechanisms. So I guess the reason that that might happen would be because if you look at histrionic personality issues, there's some of that within borderline. I think people are just confused about how to discern between them all, honestly. So
what about, have you ever had any experience in, what's that in-depth personality test?
Oh, the MBTI?
Yeah, have you ever done that?
No, I don't love personality tests. I think, you know, it's funny. There's certain assessments that I really love for helping inform, like, you know, the highly sensitive person assessment, or what's your tendency, or what's your chronotype for sleep. Like, I love little assessments that kind of give you just a little bit of information. Mm-hmm. But anything that overarchingly is supposed to tell you who you are, just my personality, I struggle with it. I don't like that whole being boxed in thing. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to tell you, I have some clients that are heavy into the Enneagram. They are all about it. Like, I'll be doing their assessment and they're like, I'm an 8 and a 1. And I'm like, what are you? Okay. Do you have depressive symptoms? like, let's get back to the clinical questions. But I mean, I feel like anything that helps you understand yourself has value though. And it's just, 100%. We're all different in how we want to learn about ourselves.
Yeah, I just learned about that from the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard trial because they did that with her.
Oh my goodness.
That was like the best time of my life.
You know, it's funny. I remember my publicist reaching out and asking if I would answer questions about that trial. And I'm like, oh,
I'm not dipping my toe in there.
Yeah. No. I talked about, what was it? Dual abuse or something. I was like, I'm not taking sides. Like, do not make me talk about one side or the other. So
good. I love for it. So how do we define suicidal ideation as opposed to just like the feeling like I don't want to live, like, or like what specifically qualifies something as being suicidal ideation?
Well, do you want to give a little more clinical response on that?
Well, I mean, a clinical response is it's almost really overly general. So any passing or active thoughts of wanting to unlive yourself and wanting to hurt yourself to the point of death is, it's the thing about the definition of suicidal ideation is that it's pretty simple. But that's why in our book, we like broke down the stages, and how there can be, look at her. She's like, let me do my homework.
Yeah, I thought it would be helpful to go through them some. Because I've had feelings like I don't want to live anymore, but I've never had like a serious thought of killing myself. So would that qualify as?
Okay, so I do think that there's three things to say for this. First of all, there's passive suicidality. I will say that. So if you are someone who has thoughts of, I just don't want to be here. I wonder what it would be like to die. I wonder what it would be like not to be here. And it's chronic enough that it's, and maybe it's connected to some level of suffering or sadness or pain, but you don't actually have a desire to follow through with it or a plan to follow through with it. That's a passive suicidality. And I will tell you, trauma, psychothymia, mood disorders, depression, very common, that you can live your whole life in that state, which is what we want to help people not experience, obviously.
Yeah.
Then there's the active suicidal thoughts where there is a plan or an intent. But within the active suicidal thoughts, as Gina's going to break it down, there's stages of severity within that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, you can have a suicidal thought and not have the desire or plan to go do it tomorrow.
I think for me, it's always been just more of a place of, I don't want to feel. Right.
You know, and there's one other thing too, that I think people get really freaked out about, that is a very natural psychological thinking pattern. So sometimes we imagine or we perseverate, like we focus on things that we're afraid of, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we want it to happen. Like for example, when I have my newborn and I'm walking down the stairs, I might imagine, please no one call the cops on me when I say this, I might imagine throwing them down the stairs.
Yep.
But it's not that I ever had that desire. It was that there's a part of me that is so afraid of something like that happening that it catastrophizes the possibility of it happening.
Yep.
So I think some people get a little confused. Oh my gosh, I'm thinking these things. Am I a terrible person? Or do I want to do these things? Breathe, connect, and know that we sometimes will flash the things we're afraid of.
Yep.
So that could also apply to suicidal thoughts too. But yeah, so we go into the steps.
Oh, I never heard you talk about that, like that level that catastrophize things. I think that's really interesting.
I know, darn, I left it out of the book.
Yeah.
No, that part, but that's interesting.
Is that a trauma? I mean, that's not necessarily like somebody who has like somebody with trauma. That's something that anybody could experience, right?
Anxiety.
It's normal, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Anxiety. I mean, just it's, you know, oh, I wonder what would happen if I ran off the road. It's not, I want to run off the road. It's, oh God, that would be really scary. Yeah. It's anyone who's feeling anxious and who's feeling, you know, overwhelmed or overstressed or anything like that. Absolutely.
All right, Gina.
Thoughts are crazy.
Phases.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's just really important because I was, you know, I always, from the people I've spoken to as well, who have on again, off again suicidal ideation at different levels, the thing is that it doesn't seem like it's something like very consistent from most people that I've talked to. So what I mean by that is, you know, they might not have this thought all year, you know, like nothing happening, you know, they're just living their life. Yes, it's up and down, but all of a sudden they lose their job. Their partner left them. Boom. They go right to this. I don't want to be here. And there's an identity. Their life is transforming in a way that they're really afraid of it. Like they're no longer going to be a wife or a husband. They're getting a divorce. They lost their job. And this is an identity that they're very attached attach to. And there's this giant fear that's coming, overwhelming them, that like there's a suffering, like life is changing in a way that they don't want. So they might all of a sudden go from this first phase that I'm talking about to the fifth phase. So that's why it's really interesting. So we wanted to break, we broke down the five phases of suicidal ideation and then also the five phases of healing. But the first phase is just contemplation, just thinking about it. It's, you know, a very low level of urgency right at this point when you're just sort of thinking about it. But then you have, and you just kind of feel like a thwarted sense of belonging, like separate from other people. You start to kind of pull yourself away and you're feeling a little bit disconnected. And then you get to the second phase, which is hopelessness, or you start to bargain with yourself and start to play the what I call the record in your head of, like, it's almost literally like a record player gets played and you're like, you're worthless. You don't belong here. Nobody loves you. Whatever the story is that you start to play in your head. And that starts to dig grooves into your soul and into your spirit, into your heart, into your belongingness. And then the third phase is really despair, where you start to kind of get sucked in. I called it the rabbit hole, where I would get sucked in. And all of a sudden, it's almost like really that disconnectedness would become very, very real. I couldn't, you start to feel numb all over your body. Like it's just, there's a numbness that starts to take over. And then you start to really get into that storyline that you're never going to be loved. You're never going to be accepted in society, or there's something wrong with you that is very, you know, you start to really start to believe those things. And then the next phase is intent. And that gets to be where it's a little bit scary. I called this the quicksand, where it's like sucking you in and there's an intention there. And that's more of a danger zone. That's where you're really starting to say a little bit, starting to make plans. So starting to give away your belongings, starting to really isolate yourself. And you become a little bit in fear for yourself at that point. And the fifth phase is action. And I labeled this the tar pit for myself, where you really feel stuck. You really feel you're making plans. You're envisioning yourself in those situations. And what is it, you know, is it going to hurt? What's going to happen? And who do you gift your dogs to? Or you start to really look into those different phases. And then we did outline the phases of healing, because we wanted to balance
and it. Sorry to butt in for a second. Oh, I would love for people to be able to experience how we laid these out in the book themselves, because we went into like really specific clinical examples. And then Gina then kind of shared how she experienced each phase.
I thought that was really beautiful.
Yeah, it was that. I think honestly, out of everything we wrote in the book, that part, these two things she's sharing right now, is what we took the most time on, because we felt like it was the most important that we got it right.
I have a few questions before you get into the healing.
Sure.
I'm curious for you, Amelia, what, as we're progressing through these phases, what's going on in the brain? What, ooh, like when we're getting question. To a, are we in fight flight mode? Like what parts are lighting up? What parts are shutting down? What's going on chemically?
Well, if you think about it this way, I look at what happens to the brain when we fall in lust, actually. So when we're falling in lust, or when we're really into someone, our serotonin drops and we become obsessive. So
don't know anything about that.
So here's the thing. When we overly fixate on something, the drop in serotonin is a big part of that. And so think about how you can go from the beginning, where it's just kind of a passing thought, to where it becomes, as Gina was saying, kind of like the record on repeat. And so that's why depression, for example, is a huge risk factor for suicidal thoughts, because there is a serotonin issue, as we know. And that's why we medicate in that way. And so if we're having these obsessive thoughts, those areas of the brain get reinforced. So if you think about, Gina had said earlier, like grooves on a record, I love using that metaphor even for the brain, because we all know what fires together, wires together. If you look at neurons, when you learn something, actually right now, as us three are talking, there are new neurons that are literally fusing together during our conversation, which is so cool. But the problem is if the neurons that are being fused together are reinforcing of suicidal thoughts, they just keep building and building and building. It's like the map, the network just gets thicker and thicker. And if you think about it this way, the areas of the brain used for grounding and coping and trust and safety, when they aren't being used as much, they're not being reinforced. And our brain literally will prune out some of the neurons that help those areas of the brain be active. Mm. Now, I would say this is the interesting thing of where the phases go from the contemplation and the obsession to the action. Has anyone, I don't know if you guys have encountered someone who's suicidal. I mean, Gina, you had this experience personally. There sometimes is a sense of calm.
I've heard that, yeah.
Towards the end. And what happens towards the end is when there's no longer the fight. The limbic system is finally able to relax. Right. And so the limbic system is much more involved in the first, you know, phases.
Is there just dysregulation in the initial? Would you say that they're in a trauma response in those earlier stages?
Well, I think the whole entire experience of suicidal thoughts is a trauma response. So I
guess I mean in fight flight mode.
You know, I think it really depends person to person, because one thing that we've talked about in other, you know, interviews is the fact that suicidal thoughts can become comforting, almost like an old friend, or I think Gina, before you said like an old blanket, like a comfortable blanket that you put on. And sometimes the suicidal thought is the coping mechanism that is used to regulate fight flight.
Would that be similar to like an addiction to excitement, and that we just feel more comfortable in chaos? Like, would that be similar to like starting a fight with a person because you grew up in a home where you learned love was chaos?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things I'm constantly working with my CPTSD clients on, and especially those who have attachment issues, is feeling comfortable in stillness. Mm-hmm. It's very uncomfortable. And not just trauma. I mean, look at our like high influence world where we have all the stimulation all the time. Our brains are so used to being so overstimulated. That's why I love the idea of if someone, I think it was part of your story, Gina, like, and this is me getting a little nerdy about it. You focused on the deep healing that you got through the spiritual work and through the people that you were with, but there was something else happening when you were on those journeys. You were pulling yourself out of a fast-paced life, and you were in these less stimulating, more grounded, more natural environments. Mm-hmm. Also. Absolutely. So there's this stillness that our brains are actually meant to be in, but we become so trained out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And would you say that at the core of it, that the underlying belief is similar amongst either like just like I'm unworthy or I'm unlovable? Do you feel like there's differentiations as far as like what is the root belief that most people are struggling with when it comes to this, just like an inherent sense of being unlovable or flawed, unfixable?
You want to speak on that?
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, you know, obviously, you know, Dr. Kelly works with veterans who are, you know, dealing with regret or
moral injury is a big one.
Or neuro injury, you know? So I think that, yeah, there is a common thing of worthlessness and unlovable, but I think it goes the gamut depending, you know, bullying. And one of the things I have fear for the youth is the bullying, you know, situations and the stories I've heard about young children wanting to leave or leaving because they've been bullied. And that's an area that we need to pull the tribe together and, you know, try to reteach or figure out how to, you know, get that to lessen, because I have a big fear, you know, about people, you know, the youth having to live through that. And how are we going to deal with that? Because I really believe that the children are mimicking the adults. So if the adults are out there bashing people online and constantly putting comments. I hate you. I hate this. You know, I don't, you know, your political thing, you know, whatever it is, but there's just so much hate and division, you know, and they look to us and they go, oh, it's okay to hate and divide. It's okay to do this. And so I think it's all of our responsibility a little bit as adults to make sure that we're creating a world that even if I don't have children, but I still care about the children and what they see online, because I know that it's trickling down to them in a way. So I self-monitor myself, not just for myself, but I put myself in, you know, I want children to, if they were ever to look at my body of work of even my social media comments, that I was respectful and kind and things like that.
I think one thing about the thinking pattern too, that if you don't mind me adding, I don't think there's any one necessarily universal thought pattern. It is very common for people to feel othered or to feel like they're not enough or feel like they're not, I like just not enough, whether it be not lovable enough, not worthy enough, not, you know, worthwhile enough. This is the main pattern, the main thing that I see threaded between everyone. Is that whatever that record is that's playing in your mind, it becomes very, very intense. So the intensity of the suffering around whatever that thought pattern is becomes intolerable. Mm-hmm. That's the piece that I see. Not necessarily that if you're walking around thinking I'm unlovable, you're more likely to be suicidal, but it's the intensity at which the thought pattern is felt. That's the common thread. It feels like there's no end to it.
Yes, absolutely. Right. And mm-hmm. So then what, as a healer, what, talk about the differences, the unique challenges of working with somebody who has suicidal ideation, that is experienced that from big T PTSD from war, as opposed mm-hmm. to somebody who experienced emotional neglect during their childhood, and just the difference between when it is something that from trauma that was that it was experienced at a time when our sense of self is being mm-hmm. cultivated, as opposed to, you know, something later on happening in adulthood.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'm assuming anybody right. though who probably experiences PTSD is more, that it's not like every single one had just like a perfectly normal and childhood either, but right.
Well, I think there's some little nuances here with belief system. I think that's kind of what it breaks down to, is that if mm-hmm. you experience complex trauma, especially during your formative years, it can completely alter your belief system about the world, and especially about relationships within the world, but your self-esteem. I think it's so important for people to understand the difference between self-esteem and confidence. So confidence is the belief that I can do things. I can do things whether or not I'm good at them. It is an energy. It's an attitude. It's a willingness to try things. Self-esteem, however, is the belief that I am inherently of value and that I deserve to be treated with respect. I deserve safety and I deserve love. And so I believe you can even see someone walking around with PTSD who's just walking around confident as all get out. And, you know, you wouldn't detect the underlying lack of self-esteem mm-hmm. in their worth, their worthiness. Mm-hmm. So I think with complex trauma, especially, that's very prevalent.
Yeah.
With veterans, I have to say, you know, a lot of the veterans I work with came from trauma. Yep, you know, there's kind of these two avenues. Either some of them go into the military because of legacy. It's, you know, something that is it
others are trying to family. Escape something, or yeah, because life circumstances led them there.
Right. They don't have options or whatnot. And so exactly. The thing of it is I do notice a distinct difference. I'm thinking of a veteran that I'm working with who there's a distinct difference in the way he was experiencing his moral injury trauma from being in Iraq. And the moral injury is when you are exposed to something traumatizing that you played some part in, or you were at least somehow involved with, that is completely opposite of what you believe. And there's such a level of cognitive dissonance that it makes you question whether you are even a worth person to live, like whether you are good and pure and that you just have value at all. So you can see how it cuts into self-esteem for a different reason.
Yeah.
not because the people who raised you didn't make you feel that you had the self-esteem and self-worth, but because of something, quote, you did or witnessed.
Yeah, yeah. You failed.
Right, right. Whereas when it's, let's say someone like, geez, all these people who just experienced these hurricanes, right? So PTSD is absolutely going to be part of many of their stories. But the trauma might be more connected to, you know, certain stimuli, certain events, certain fear of a lack of security. Like there's these things that can happen that aren't necessarily connected to your
sense of self.
Sense of self. Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. More sensory.
Right. Well, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be, it can, I mean, safety can make you feel and believe things about the world, but there's just something so different when your trauma is connected to the very thing that can heal your suicidality, which is relationships and connection.
No shit.
Mm-hmm.
No shit. Yeah, I'm curious, and I don't know if I asked you this last time, but from what you've seen in working with people, specifically with EMDR, and this is something that my old therapist told me, was that when it comes to using EMDR for like a big T trauma that is more mm-hmm. recent, that like the effects of that can be pretty drastic and pretty mm-hmm. sudden. Mm-hmm. As opposed to when you're using it to treat more little T trauma, complex PTSD, that's something that you more so see a shift in thinking patterns over time. Has that been mm-hmm. your experience in working with folks?
Absolutely. I mean, for instance, I have one rotating EMDR spot open for traumas that are acute. Mm-hmm. So I don't have space for another ongoing client, but I kind of keep that one spot open. And this is for, you know, car accident, or, you know, it could even be something like death of a loved one, you know, if there was not complex trauma connected to that relationship. So it can be these single incident experiences, because you're not trying to override deep belief systems. You're more so addressing the acute response. I do want to caution, I don't do any EMDR. Other than resource, I might do a little resource tapping. I don't do any targeted trauma work within the first 3 to 4 weeks, because you need to assess first whether or not the person has acute stress disorder. Yep. And you want to make sure those first 2 to 3 weeks, especially the nervous system is so hijacked that I think it can be counterproductive. But for example, I am starting EMDR with a client of mine whose spouse was hit by a car in front of them a couple weeks ago, but this is also a complex PTSD client of mine. So now we've got this double whammy. So the way that I'm having to do the acute trauma work with this client is a lot more gentle than I would normally be able to address uh-huh. an acute trauma, because this client already has all these fears that we've been working on for years.
Yeah.
So it's very layered.
Well, somebody wouldn't, when you say that you would wait 3 to 4 weeks. I mean,
or more.
Yeah. But would you not consider that being part of the I mean, isn't part of the initial phase of it anyways, like establishing like whether or not this person has like tools and is even able to do the process? Or would you say that that's different?
Well, I mean, when I do trauma work, for me, it's all about building trust and relationship.
Yeah,
and
but I'm saying those first few phases of EMDR, right? Like phases, like, well, aren't those initial ones just like the cultivating the safety and trust components of it?
Oh, sure. Yeah. However, that's a good point. I wouldn't necessarily engage them in the active EMDR therapy, but all of the psychoeducation, the assessing, the setting up, making sure they understand it, building trust, all of that is absolutely appropriate to do early on. But I've had times where someone, like I said, a car accident contacted me. They had a car accident 6 months prior. They can't drive past the place without feeling nauseous. So they come in, we'll do an assessment, we'll do an introductory session. I send them home with their self-assessment form for EMDR. They come in and we can go for it mm-hmm. because it's not in the moment, it's not acute, and it's a very specific thing we're targeting.
Yep.
Right.
Interesting. What modalities were most helpful for you, Gina?
Well, I didn't even tell my therapist, which is interesting. I'm doing a documentary right now, and we did a trailer with my therapist, and I didn't even tell him. and that I had these suicidal thoughts at
Okay.
all. So we talked about that, how it's, yeah, it's, I was even afraid to tell him. I didn't tell anybody. I told one person and they said, well, that's above my pay grade. It was a friend. And that was the only person I told.
So what did you
But
tell him when you first started working with him?
I worked with him because he was helping me through a rape, actually, that I had at the workplace. So I went to him for that. And so I had a new trauma that I was dealing with. And he really helped me through that. I just want to just give a big thank you to all the therapists out there. Thank you, Dr. Kelly, and all the people that work with you. I mean, they really do such great work, especially when you get one that really listens and,
Knows, yeah, knows what the fuck they're talking about.
oh my gosh, like he's amazing. I love him so much. Like, and he was hard on me. I would leave and I would just be like, holy moly. So I did have therapy. I didn't take any medication because I'm really sensitive. Even if I have a cup of coffee, I can feel it. So I wasn't a candidate for that. He was like, that's going to maybe highlight any kind of things going on with you. But the biggest thing that helped me, it was my education around energy and how I can affect my own energy and how I can change it. So what that means for me is learning how to do yoga, meditation, that this, I could just change this. I could transform this sorrow, this heaviness, because I think anybody that feels sorrow or suffering or heaviness, it's a feeling. Like you can feel it in your body. You like drag your feet, like you feel heavy. You feel that there's a cloud over your head. But when you start to stretch and work out and go on the beach and listen to music and find whatever, you can actually feel it lifting, So I really was paying more attention to, oh my gosh, I would, after I would meditate, I went into a heavy meditation and class that in school where we really broke down energy and I learned about how energy affects us and we would practice with each other. It was like almost like a college. I went 3 times a week.
What kind of
Well,
meditation technique, or what was it
it's called the
called?
Berkeley Psychic Institute, but what it is really the understanding of how to move energy and transform it. So I could really bond with my intellectual self, my intelligence and my own body, and that this whole body has so many cues in it. When you say I have a stomach ache, and why do you have that? Is it something you ate, or is there a PTSD response to something? So I just, learned about my physical body has so many cues for me, and I want to, and that helped me transform out of the thing in my head. So now I have a whole like toolbox of different things when I'm, because I still have PTSD. I was telling Dr. Kelly this morning, I woke up with extreme anxiety and I'm not sure it's like the Halloween energy, but energy affects me. So I've been grounding all morning. I took a hot bath. I go on the walk with the beach, but I know that it's like that's helping me transform this thing that it is just comes over me. So I have a toolkit that works for me. And I think everybody has to curate their own little mini toolkit. They have to have their own like little, these are the people that know who I am and I can call. These are, you have to just sort of curate your own thing with your own awareness and saying, okay, like I'm not feeling good today, and not take it like I'm a bad person or why am I feeling this way again? And going into that old mindset, it's more like, okay, what can I do to transform this right now, quick, as best so I can feel better. And I, number one, the thing is I don't talk down to myself and say, oh, why aren't you perfect? Why aren't you, why do you have to feel this way? And all that stuff. I'm like, yep, it's just a thing that I have to deal with.
I would love to like say how important what she does is for trauma recovery, because I think there's a misconception that only messed up people, or only traumatized people, or only people who are broken need to use all these coping skills. Why do I have to use all these coping skills? I've had so many clients say things like that to me. And I try to remind them, in actuality, we are designed to naturally cope and take care of ourselves. If we look at the way I take care of my kids, for instance, I make sure that they've eaten. I make sure that they're, well rested. I make sure they're not overstimulated. I make sure they have time to play. These are things that we hopefully, if we don't experience these traumatized histories as much, learn inherently to do. Mm-hmm. So anytime you engage in a coping mechanism, it's not because, oh gosh, I'm so screwed up, I need more coping mechanisms. It's actually, wow, this is my way of counteracting all the trauma. This is the opposite of a trauma response. Using the coping skill, meditation, whatever it is the opposite of a trauma response.
100%. Mm-hmm. Okay, I have a question from somebody in my community. I thought this was really interesting. So she said, I have a friend with a family member with DID.
Okay.
And I know that this is an issue that the family deals with, suicidal ideation. And I know that there is a high percentage of folks with DID that do actually attempt suicide. I'd be interested in knowing how best to support someone in this situation, but the person with DID as well as the family members. Have you heard that before?
So they are worried that the DID is going to increase suicidal ideation?
No, she said that she's heard that. She's heard that there is a high percentage of folks with DID in suicidal ideation. Have you heard of that?
Well, the only reason I would say there may be some validity to that is because DID is generally a trauma response.
Yeah.
And so it's deeply connected to trauma, and trauma is deeply connected, is one of the risk factors of many for suicidal thoughts. So I think one of the things when I think about DID, it almost, remember I was saying earlier how with a common thread for suicidality is things that are overly intense,
yeah,
like emotions and thoughts that are overly intense. If we look at IFS, which you and I love, we've talked about internal family systems, right? IFS,
I had a session right before this interview.
Well, there you go. So in IFS, we're looking at ourselves as a collection of parts, right? So we're almost purposely separating ourselves.
Yeah.
So when we're not overly enmeshed, or we're not overly intertwined, or we're not being flooded by our parts, we can negotiate with all of them. There's not a too muchness to it. There's this ability to heal from it. But with DID, it's like the parts are just completely running the show.
Yeah.
Right. They're all consuming. They're running the show. And so just like I was saying earlier, it's the too muchness, the intensity at which it's experienced, that is the common thread for suicidality.
I loved all the breakdown of all the various modalities. And even just for that, I highly recommend people reading this book. I would like to talk about, like, I think would be important, a lot of people need to hear about is, like, for folks that have family and friends that are struggling with this, like, what do they need to know? Like, what do they need to not do? What do they need to do? What do they need to research? What do they need to understand? Like,
Do you want me to speak on this one, Gina?
Sure. I just want to say that's the whole reason why we created the book. You know, there's resources in the back. There's a safety plan in there. There's exercises from Dr. Kelly. There's exercises from me. If you don't want to tell anybody, you could buy the book. We made it affordable for people. That's what we love about our publisher. They only made it, even though it's a big hefty workbook. I mean, it's not a little thing. It's only $20, because they will even probably send you a digital copy if you're in need and don't have $20 at the Swedenborg Foundation, because, you know, maybe you don't want to tell anybody. You can order this online and you can start doing the work right now. But this, you know, I really say to people to, you know, to calm down, not panic, and really just try to listen and follow their cadence, as in, what can I do for you? Do you want me to research something from you? Do you want me, you want to just go and talk about it? You know, maybe you're too overwhelmed to look for a doctor. I could do that for you. Or just being calm and gentle and just inquiring and follow their cadence, you know, as long as, you know, what can we do? I don't know. That's the way that I always tell people, you know, just listen to them and just gently go into it instead of a panic mode. And like, what do you think?
Right. Oh, I mean, I completely agree as far as like what the energy that is helpful would be. I do want to acknowledge that for anyone hearing that someone's suicidal, I mean, even after 10,000 hours of therapy, if I have a client who tells me that they're having suicidal thoughts, you know, my toes curl a little, you know, like I have a reaction because I'm human, and it's a reaction of desire to help and save the person and make sure they're okay. So it's natural. I think I want to tell people it's natural to have an initial fear response if you hear of someone that you love and care about is having these thoughts.
But like Gina was saying, anything you can do to stay grounded, breathe into the moment and try to be present can be helpful. But this is the big thing too. It should not lie solely on your shoulders.
Mm.
So you don't need to be the gatekeeper for this entire, I don't want to say, I'm so glad we didn't say this word the whole time. I don't even want to say it, burden, but like, you don't need to have all of this on your shoulders. It's good to make sure that your loved one or whoever it is has a therapist, has a doc if they need one. If they're spiritual, connecting with their, you know, with whoever that spiritual support is, whether it be their pastor or their meditation teacher, like, it's good to have a team of people around someone who is having these thoughts, and it does not need to solely lie on your shoulders to carry them all on your own. I think that's very important.
And that brings up something interesting as well, too, is as far as, you know, if at a certain point, and for some people, if this is, you know, think about it from like alcoholism or addiction, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
at a certain point, and it's like, is it okay? Is it not okay? Like, somebody might at a certain point, like, they can't be involved. I would think that maybe that at a certain point, if it could be somebody who it's just too detrimental to them, or
mm-hmm.
yeah, here you can say it all. But like, thoughts on that, you know, like, I'm just kind of thinking about it from like a perspective of like, I guess if somebody's not willing to get help.
Yeah. I mean, the thing of it is that there, I think there's two big things with this. If you continue to show up and you continue to listen and be supportive and be available, and that's the extent of what you carry and what you hold. At the end of the day, and Gina can probably attest to this, it does also come down to that individual person's desire to heal,
yeah,
and their desire to do the work. And however hard you want to do the work for them, you can't. And however, just because someone doesn't look like they want to do the work, doesn't look like they're getting it, doesn't look like they're going to heal, it doesn't mean that we need to, in my opinion, run so far back that we're not available at all. But figuring out to what extent you can be available where you personally still feel safe and you're still taking care of yourself first.
Yeah.
Is really important.
Yeah.
From some, yeah.
I'm thinking about just from like a codependency perspective. And like, you know, for some people, like I could just see them really losing that they need to have their own personal boundaries. And when they don't, I would imagine they're probably making it worse in some respects. You know, if they put it all on them. Well, this book is amazing. Highly recommend it. Beautiful job. Way to tackle quite a heavy topic in a very informational, palatable, not super overwhelming, very informative. You did a beautiful job.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, I'll put it in the show notes, and it was great to have you guys.
Thank you
for doing this podcast.